Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. For the better part of the last year, the Perseverance rover has been exploring Jezero Crater on Mars. And since 2012, the Curiosity rover has been investigating Gale Crater on the Red Planet. Recently, Curiosity took a stunning image of the view from its perch heading up the slope of Mount Sharp. And we'll talk to the rover's engineering camera team lead, Doug Ellison, about that picture later on in the show. We'll also take a look at the family tree of the rovers on Mars and how they're related indirectly to the lunar rovers that the Apollo astronauts used in the final three moon missions from 1971 to 1972 with author and rover expert Earl Swift. But first, let's catch up on Perseverance, the heaviest and most capable rover to ever drive on another world. Our guest is systems engineer and planetary scientist Vivian Sun. Vivian is a member of the Perseverance team based at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Vivian Sun, welcome to Blue Dot.
Great, thanks for having me here.
Before we get into what's going on up on Mars in Jezero Crater with Percy, I'd like to know more about you. Can you tell us about how you got first interested in planetary science?
Yeah, so I have been interested in kind of space and just the sciences in general ever since I was a little kid, as is probably true for a lot of other folks in this field. You know, as a kid, I was always interested in kind of understanding things about Earth's past. You know, I was very interested in dinosaurs. I eventually started getting interested into kind of space topics. I especially remember, you know, when I was a high schooler, I was taking a chemistry class, and we had a final research paper that we could write on whatever we wanted. And I did some poking around on the internet, and eventually I landed on the topic of stellar nucleosynthesis, which is basically like how the stars, have hydrogen. They make that into helium and all the other elements that we have in our world now. And you know, as a high schooler, that just kind of blew my mind. And it got me.
Yeah, when you see the periodic table up there in front of your classroom, you don't realize, hey, stars did that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was definitely my reaction. And, that was kind of a rabbit hole that I just got deeper and deeper into. And so I think that was kind of the start that I could remember of understanding, you know, there's a whole field that studies, you know, outer space and stars and all those things that I hadn't thought about before. And so I kind of ran with that interest. I went to Caltech for my undergraduate degree. And there, I learned more about astrophysics. I also learned more about planetary science, which I didn't really know was a thing, but it definitely is a little closer to home, right? Because we're actually looking at planets that we have visited with our orbiters and other satellites and even rovers and things like that. And of course, this was after MIR, Opportunity, and Spirit had landed and had made their discoveries. And so it was definitely a big field then. And I was starting to get my kind of feet wet with that as well. So after undergrad, I also had the opportunity to do a few research projects, and I kind of dabbled here and there, you know, some projects looking at Jupiter's atmosphere and other projects looking at terrestrial data. But it wasn't until I was nearing the end of my time as an undergrad when I was doing a research internship at JPL, studying dust devil tracks on Mars and understanding, you know, how the tracks reflect what the direction of the wind was. And for me, for some reason, that was such a tangible experience that I just thought it was so great to be looking at the satellite data from another planet and then being able to link that to something as, like concrete as wind directions. And so that's kind of where I started really thinking, you know, I was really interested in terrestrial planets, you know, planets that had a surface, that had geology that could be traced to perhaps, you know, earlier in Earth's history. There might be some similarities there. And in particular, Mars was kind of that planet that really spoke out to me. And so after undergrad, I decided I wanted to go to graduate school to do more research, because I found that was something that I really loved doing as an undergrad, was the research projects and kind of finding out, you know, the little bits of new information that one does when they're doing research. And so I went to graduate school, did a doctorate degree in planetary science at Brown University. There I focused on studying Mars, especially using remote sensing data, not only looking at the images of the surface to interpret the geology, but also using spectroscopic data sets to look at the minerals and the composition of the rocks on the surface of Mars. And I really loved kind of doing the, you know, the synergistic studies of both the geology and the mineralogy to make interpretations about where there might have been water, what that past environment might have been like. And so that really was my my graduate experience. And I also had the very fortunate opportunity to become involved with rover missions during that time. So my my graduate advisor, Ralph Milliken, is on the MSL science team. And through him, I was
Curiosity.
Yes, the Curiosity rover. Mm-hmm. And I was able to participate in rover operations as a graduate student, which was just, you know, something I never thought I would be doing, because I just didn't know that there was that opportunity. Yeah, it's really cool. Like as a graduate student, especially to think about, you know, like you're actually contributing to helping the team put together these plans that are going to be executed on a different planet by this rover. And so that was just something that I felt was really fulfilling and a great addition to my graduate career.
And then what did it feel like when you found out you were going to be a part of this particular rover, Perseverance?
Yeah, that was a very exciting moment. So that happened when I came to JPL as a postdoc, and I was very fortunate to work with Katie Stack Morgan, who is the deputy project scientist for Perseverance. And as a postdoctoral student, you know, I worked with the rest of the Mars 2020 science team, even back when we were looking at just the different landing sites, because we hadn't actually selected Perseverance.
Go ahead. Tell us about selecting the landing site.
Yeah. So way back when, we hadn't actually selected JESRO as our landing site. We were looking at a number of other different candidates. For example, the Northeast Syrtis region, as it was called then, other areas of Mars, of course. And back then, you know, the science team was just looking at the orbital data that we had over these locations and trying to figure out, you know, where would we get the best return for science from the payload and the rover that we'd be sending. And so I was fortunate to be a part of that team as a postdoctoral researcher. And I also got my feet wet in a little more on the operational side of things on both Curiosity and on Perseverance. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then I found myself being very fortunate to be offered a job as a systems engineer on the Perseverance rover. And so that's kind of how I got to where I am today.
And let's talk about what Perseverance has been doing in JESRO crater. Now that you've been exploring it for a while, is it turning out to be, you know, everything you guys thought it would be? Is it a great place to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question, because there's several different ways to answer it, I think. You know, there's definitely the aspects of JESRO that now that we've landed, you know, we've confirmed some things that we have for a long time hypothesized from the orbital remote data. One example of this is, of course, you know, we knew coming into JESRO that there would be a delta deposit, which is that, you know, the famous delta image that has been shown everywhere. And we had very good evidence just from the orbital data that this was very likely a delta deposit, just based on you know, the morphology of this unit and the different measurements that folks have made just based on the orbital data. It was very convincing that this was a delta deposit and that there used to be a lake in JESRO. And so once we landed, of course, it's always nice to get confirmation that your hypotheses were correct, or that the community's hypotheses were correct. And so, of course, once we landed, one of the first things that we wanted to image was towards the delta front, and even towards some of the remnants that we hypothesize are remnants of the delta that have since eroded back. And so some of the images that we took in even the first 100 sols of the mission were observations that were confirming what we had hypothesized. You know, we saw things like crossbedding and conglomerates in the delta front and in the delta remnants. And, you know, it's always great to get confirmation that, yeah, we hypothesized that this would be a delta deposit. We'd see evidence for, you know, fluvial flow as in rivers, and we'd also see some other deposits that come in a lacustrine or fluvial setting, you know, in a lake and at the river mouth. Those were all things that we kind of had expected to see, could not see from orbit just because of the, you know, the resolution that we have in the orbital data is just not sufficient to resolve such fine scale features. But when we landed and pointed our cameras towards the delta and the remnants, you know, we got confirmation of there being a delta there that we were looking at.
Yeah, and there's kind of two possibilities: that Jezero crater filled in like a flash flood event, and then, you know, quickly the water disappeared, or it could have been hung around a while. Are you seeing any evidence one way or the other to show, you know, how long the water lasted in the crater?
Yeah, that is a really good question. And the answer to that is rather complicated, I would say, because, you know, there are, even though we do have these beautiful sequences of layered rocks, and of course that layering tells us, you know, something about the order of deposition, with things at the bottom being older and things towards the top being younger. Even though we have that relative sense of time, it is still difficult to understand the duration of these events and when they occurred in terms of, you know, how many billions of years ago. So there's kind of two aspects that feed into those conversations. And one is, of course, the timing of when these activities actually happened in terms of how many billions of years ago. And for that, what's really important is actually the unit that we're on right now, which is the crater floor. And so, of course, you know, we're not at the delta yet. We haven't interrogated any of those rocks up close with our rover payload, but we are on the crater floor. And it's actually a really important unit because it contacts with the delta. And so by understanding what is the age of the unit that we're currently sitting on, that can help us constrain, you know, when the delta might have formed once we get closer to the delta and are able to analyze, you know, what is the relationship between the delta rocks and the crater floor rocks that we're on right now. And so that's kind of one aspect, is when in time the delta formed. That's a big outstanding question. I think the other question that you were asking is, like, what was the duration of these aqueous events, right?
Yeah, did the water hang around long enough? Because, of course, you know, the big question is, was this an environment that was conducive for microbial life to form or to thrive? Is there any indications thus far that the water hung around for a while?
Yeah, and that is a number that I think we can constrain in terms of potentially, you know, like the minimum amount of time it would take to deposit this amount of sediment. And to do that exactly, I believe it would be difficult to do with, you know, just our rover instruments. There would need to be some comparison to, for example, analogous locations on Earth. For example, understanding how long, what is the sedimentation rate needed to accumulate, you know, this many meters of lacustrine mudstones in a similar environment on Earth. And then from there, you can kind of extrapolate to what we might be seeing at Jezero. But the answer is also even further complicated because there is for certain a lot of erosion that happens on Mars. And of course, the evidence for this is in what we currently see in the landscape around us right now. We see a lot of sand, we see a lot of remnants, like the remnants that I was mentioning of the delta. So clearly a lot of erosion has taken place in Jezero crater. And where that can further complicate things is if we have periods of deposition that are followed by erosion that erodes away some of the sediments that have been deposited. And then we have another period of deposition after that. And so that produces what we call an unconformity, where if you look at the rock record, you know, you see that there's a clear kind of
missing chunk of time.
Yeah. And so that can make it difficult because, you know, if you don't know when the period of erosion happened, then it could be that, you know, the first unit was deposited 3 billion years ago, if I'm just, you know, saying, for example, and then there could have been, you know, a billion years after that when the next episode of sedimentation happened. And that's, of course, just purely hypothetical, but, you know, it can be very hard to constrain those missing chunks of time.
And you've mentioned the lacustrine deposits, that those are more like still water, like lake deposits, as opposed to fluvial, which is flowing water, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And those types of deposits are where we would expect to see kind of finer grain material, because that's the kind of material that settles out in the middle of a lake, as opposed to in the higher energy margins of a lake, or where the river is flowing in. And so that is, from terrestrial experience, definitely one of the better places to look for potential biosignatures, just because they're more easily preserved in those type of quiescent environments.
I saw that recently that there, the basaltic, you know, lava deposits have salts associated with them. Could you explain to us what the importance of that is?
Yes, absolutely. So the importance of the salts is, of course, that it is evidence for there having been aqueous alteration, or that there were fluids that had gone through this rock and interacted with that rock to alter parts of it and produce those salts that we have been observing. So obviously, from, you know, anytime fluids are involved, that becomes very interesting astrobiologically, because, you know, we immediately think about how, you know, there was water going through this rock, how much water was going through this rock, and for how long. And of course, that has implications for how habitable that environment might have been. And getting into kind of more details that were, of course, the team is still working out, but understanding the types of salts can also be helpful for understanding what type of water flowed through that rock. So for example, the pH of the water can matter. If it's a very acidic pH of the fluid that was going through and altering these rocks, then, you know, perhaps that might be considered less habitable than if it were kind of more neutral alkaline pH waters that were running through that rock, just kind of more what we are familiar with here on Earth in terms of supporting, you know, the life that we have in the terrestrial environments.
Well, putting your engineering hat on for a moment, how well is the rover performing in all of its instrumentation? Is Perseverance healthy?
Absolutely. Yeah, Perseverance is doing amazingly healthy. As you probably heard, our first 100 sols were due to rover and instrument checkouts. And so that was a period where we were just kind of running through our activities for the first time and just making sure that everything was operating as expected. And Perseverance passed with flying colors.
Well, that's very good to hear. And as a scientist, you know, I always find it interesting to think about how engineering and instrumentation allows you to do science. So it's the engineers provide the systems that allow the scientists to answer their questions. Being someone involved in both, you know, describe to us how wonderful this rover is for you as a scientist, you know, looking at all the engineering marvels that are on it.
Yeah, it is definitely a very collaborative relationship that we have amongst the scientists and the engineers on this mission. You know, in, of course, for all Mars missions, it's like that. But, you know, to experience it for myself for this mission, especially during the development, you know, where we're gathering science requirements and trying to have conversations about, you know, if we want to look at this rock with this level of fidelity, you know, what are the requirements that are needed for the instruments or for the rover to ensure that we get those requirements implemented into the actual hardware and components on the rover. There's definitely a lot of back and forth, you know, between and iterations between the scientists and engineers. And I think that's really one of the things that I love most about working on big missions like this, is just seeing how, you know, everyone has their little piece to contribute towards this much bigger goal, right? None of this could be really achievable by a smaller team. It really takes our big team with all of our kind of wide breadth of expertise to come together and to make this mission a success.
Yeah. And you mentioned you just came off shift, right?
Yes, I did.
So could you explain to our listeners what that's like to be on shift? Because you're literally, when you talk about souls, those are a day on Mars, which is slightly longer than a day on Earth. Could you explain what it's like to live in Mars time during one of these missions?
Absolutely. So Mars time was a period of time at the very beginning of the mission, right after we landed. And basically Mars time comes out of that day discrepancy that you just mentioned. So every day is a very dynamic day where we're constantly reacting to the results of the plan that we uplinked the day before. And so Mars time comes out of this because of that 40-minute difference in the Martian day and the Earth day, we get out of sync sometimes because in a perfect world, we would just be constantly uplinking, downlinking. And because Mars and Earth have the same length of day, we'd be on the same cycle. But because Mars's day is actually 40 minutes longer, that actually results in us having to start our shifts 40 minutes later every single day if we were on Mars time. And so, you know, today we might be starting our shift at 8 a.m. so that we can create a plan and send it up in time for the rover to finish yesterday's plan and then start on today's plan. But because of the 40-minute difference, tomorrow, for example, we might be starting at 8:40 and then, you know, the day after at 9:20. And so that's kind of the essence behind Mars time.
And that adds up over time where you're working all kinds of crazy hours, and it's like you're living on Mars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So during Mars time, we had a lot of memorable nights where we would, you know, come in for our shift starting at 3 a.m. And then, you know, work our hours until that shift was over and then start the next day at 3:40 a.m. So it definitely builds a lot of camaraderie.
And I love some of the names of the instruments, like, you know, they're just great names. Supercam, Watson, Sherlock. And since it's a lot of fun, what's one of your, before we let you go, what's your favorite aspect of working on this mission?
Yeah, my favorite aspect would definitely be the people that I work with. And I know it's cliche to say that, but every single day that I come in for my shift, it's true. It's just the people that I work with, that we all work with here are, we just all have a, you know, that single dedication to this mission and to making sure that, you know, every plan that we uplink is the best plan that it can be. You know, I think everyone here just has an amazing level of enthusiasm and commitment to making this rover mission be a success. And, you know, I think it really comes through in times where, for example, every mission will encounter some, you know, anomalies or times where something is uncertain. But I think it's during those times when the team, when you really see the team just get together, put our brains together and do all that we can to, you know, resolve the issue. And I think that's been the case for, you know, the other Mars rover missions, certainly is the case for Perseverance as well. But for me, I think it's really the people and the team that we have that I work with that make it a really worthwhile experience.
Well, thank you, Vivian. Appreciate you spending the time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks to our guest, NASA JPL Systems Engineer and Planetary Scientist Vivian Sun. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll find out about a very cool picture captured by Perseverance's sister rover, Curiosity. Stay with us. And we're back. Now let's turn our attention from Perseverance to the Curiosity rover, which has been exploring an equally interesting part of Mars, Gale Crater. In the past year, it's been climbing the slopes of Mount Sharp, and recently, the Curiosity team released a stunning, colorful image of the view from Curiosity's engineering cameras looking back down into Gale Crater. Joining us to talk about it is the camera team's lead, Doug Ellison. Doug, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Well, I took note of this picture that I saw where Curiosity sent a postcard from Mars, and it's really stunning. Could you tell us just a little bit the backstory about how you guys decided, why you decided to do this?
So we don't often have time with a mission like Curiosity to stop and smell the roses, but occasionally we do. And so we're in the middle of a drill campaign where we collect samples with the drill on the end of the robotic arm, and we normally take a couple of weeks to get that done. And our normal imaging from the drive that got us to this location was pretty good, to be honest. But our project scientist, Ashwin Vasavada, he said, hey, do you reckon we could take like some of our post-drive imaging again? And so I said, well, let's do a little postcard. In fact, let's take that postcard twice, because we have this gorgeous view across the floor of Gale Crater. You've got the rim of the crater about 30 miles away to the north-northwest. You've got most of our mission kind of laid out in the middle distance. And so we designed a little observation. We took it about 8:30 in the morning and then about 4:30 in the afternoon, Mars time. And when they came down, I thought, you know, is there some cool or creative or artistic way we could merge these? So I just did a very simple trick. I took the mosaic we took in the afternoon and I assigned that basically to orange colors, which is how people normally expect Mars to appear. And then Mars is actually freezing cold. People think of warm brown colors, but Mars is a freezing cold planet. And so I took that morning mosaic and put it in kind of those cooler, bluer colors, and it just came together beautifully. And when I shared it with some of the people on the project, and Ashwin in particular, he's like, we've got to release this somehow. And so we worked with our media office, and our little postcard made it out to the public.
Yeah, and what I really like about it is Curiosity is like sitting up on this little perch, looking back, you know, down through this gully and then across the Gale Crater. And so it's just like, it almost says, look how far I've come.
It really is. I mean, we've climbed several hundred meters up the foothills of Mount Sharp, and we've got many, many hundreds more meters of exploring to do up ahead of us. But the views over the past few months have been particularly spectacular, and it's always been spectacular in our rearview mirror. Like, we're climbing up the hill, and when we do a drive, you know, a good day's driving might be 50 meters or so, but when we finish a drive, we take a complete 360-degree mosaic with our little engineering cameras, and that view out the back of the rover, kind of over the power supply and the antennas that are kind of festooned to the back of the rover, always seem to have this beautiful kind of late afternoon lighting to them. Sometimes the dust is a little thicker, and so things look a little hazier. Sometimes it's a little clearer. We're crawling out of winter towards spring right now, so the air is a little clearer. It's a little stiller than normal, and so right now, we're just blessed with these gorgeous views. It's a privilege to get to take these pictures.
So you said you cover about 50 meters a day. That's typical?
Yeah, you know, on a really, really good day, perhaps a little more. Oh, sometimes perhaps a little less. It's a mixture of how much time do we have to drive in a given day, which normally is driven by how much power we have, but also how far can we see in our pictures. We don't like to really drive, generally speaking, into places that we can't see, because you don't know, you know, what's lying around the corner. So we tend to drive about as far as we can see in a given day.
That's an interesting point. Can you tell us a bit about your role and the engineering camera's role that it plays in navigating this rover? Because as you said, it's not an completely autonomous machine. And you can't drive this thing with a joystick because of the time delay. You know, it takes, 15, 20 minutes for the commands to go up there and then back again, right?
Yeah, it's depending on where Earth and Mars are right in the solar system. It can be as little as 5, but right now it's actually pretty much as bad as it gets, about 20 or so. So our cameras, we have little fisheye cameras on the front and the back of the rover called hazard cameras. Think of like the kind of backup camera you might have on your car. And then we have navigation cameras up on top of the mast. You can think of it as like a big tripod on top of the rover. And they're all basically rebuilds of cameras that were originally designed for the old Spirit and Opportunity rovers in 2003. So these cameras are almost a 20 plus year old design at this point. So they're black and white, they're 1 megapixel, right? They're not great, but they get the job done. So we use them to document whatever the rover is doing in terms of using its robotic arm. And then anytime we drive, when we finish the drive, we take a complete 360-degree mosaic in stereo. That is kind of a left eye and a right eye. And that stereo data gets turned into a 3D model that our rover planners, the rover driving team, can use to plan where are we going to drive the rover next. and our science team can use to identify interesting targets. Like, hey, that rock right in front of us, that's the one we'd like to touch with the robotic arm, or that direction over there is what we'd like to go next. And so we can plan a route kind of where the science team wants us to go using these pictures. And we can, if we have kind of more time than we have kind of range from our cameras, we can actually say to the rover, hey, you know, using your very sensible head, go a little bit further if you think it's safe to do so. And it'll actually use these exact same cameras, take pictures ahead of itself and go, okay, it's safe, I can go a bit more. Okay, it's still safe, I can go a bit more. Okay, it's a little bit rocky off to the right, so I'll just jink a little bit to the left. And we can actually extend how far we can drive by kind of having the rover do the exact same thing we would do, but with its own little computer on board. It's very, very slow, but sometimes we even have the rover drive itself as well.
Have there been times where things got a little bit sketchy for the rover, as far as maybe getting in a spot where it took a little maneuvering to get it, you know, keep from being stuck, as it were?
So we exercise a lot of caution. In fact, we have a member of the science team who works with our rover driving team every time we plan, called the surface property scientist. Their job is to kind of look at the lay of the land and go, yeah, you can probably drive across that, that's going to be fine, or that looks a bit jaggedy, or maybe that's a bit sandy. And so we exercise quite a lot of caution. But there have been times where we have, you know, basically gone, okay, we want to get up this little steep slope here. Truth be told, the best way is probably to stick it in drive and gun it. And we've exceeded slopes of 30 degrees or more. And yeah, wow. if you could stand right next to the rover and watch it doing, we have a copy of the rover here on Earth that we use for kind of as a stunt double. It's for testing things and trying out new techniques and stuff like that. And it makes a horrible sound because we have these metallic wheels and they're driving on rock. And so it's kind of clinking and clunking and scratching, and it makes an awful noise, especially if you're climbing up a slope. Now you're getting a little bit of wheel spin as well. It sounds awful, but we just get to enjoy it with a few snapshots along the way. And then, hey, I made it on top of the hill. Here's the glorious panorama. But we have an incredible team of rover planners who plan out these drives, and the science team who, you know, have an appreciation for what the rover can and can't do. And they'll sometimes say, hey, we really want to get to this particular thing up here. Can we do it? And we'll do our absolute best to get the rover wherever it is the science team want to do. And truthfully, she hasn't let us down yet.
Well, and one of the things that was cool about this picture, of the many things, was it was a nice reminder, because everybody's been paying so much attention to Perseverance and the Ingenuity helicopter and that incredible mission, is that, you know, Curiosity is still doing incredible science there in Gale Crater, and has been since what, 2012?
Yeah, we just crossed this Thanksgiving. We crossed the 10th anniversary of our launch from Florida. I was there for the launch in 2011. And this coming fall of 2022 will be our 10th anniversary on the surface of Mars. And we've covered, you know, more than 20 kilometers, you know, 15 plus miles. We have a very healthy, functional rover. Our science instruments still work. Our cameras still work. We can still drive. We can still use the robotic arm. We can still drill samples. You know, things are getting a little rickety. You know, anyone who's outlived their design life by that much will start to feel the ages. But still an incredibly productive rover, still making discoveries. And I think we can keep going for kind of as long as the powers that be deem us fit to be funded to keep going.
Well, again, thanks for sharing this amazing image with us. And for folks that want to see it, what's the easiest way for them to go about that?
Easiest place to find everything you do is at mars.nasa.gov, or on social media, you can normally find what Curiosity is up to at Mars Curiosity.
Well, Doug Ellison, Curiosity Rover Engineering Camera Team Lead, thanks so much for telling us about how Curiosity is doing and sharing this amazing picture postcard with us.
Thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thanks to Doug Ellison, Engineering Camera Team Lead for the NASA Curiosity Rover on Mars. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll learn a bit about the family history of extraterrestrial rovers with author Earl Swift. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest Earl Swift is the author of the new book, Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Earl, before we get into our discussion of the family tree of rovers, how did you first get interested in this project?
Well, I turned 13 the day that Apollo 15 landed on the moon on July 30th, 1971. And I have very little recollection of the missions that came before, mostly because I was a little kid. We lived in England in 1969 when Apollo 11 landed, and it landed in the dead of night over there. So my parents didn't let me stay up late enough to watch the actual first step. It wasn't until 15 that I really had a personal awareness that there was something pretty interesting going on up there. And partly that was because I was a teenager by now and a little more aware in general. And partly it was because we had moved to Houston and it was impossible to get away from the Apollo story in 1971, living in Houston. But mostly it was because the astronauts carried with them a new piece of gear that I thought was just exceedingly cool. And that was that they took a car with them. So I have very clear recollections of watching Apollo 15 on the moon live. And as it happened, the mission was pretty much engineered to get a big TV audience. The first rover excursion began airing right at breakfast time and on a weekend. And so you had really no excuse not to watch.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And then, but what drove you to want to write a book about this? When did you know? Because you wrote this book just recently. What made you decide to undertake that?
Well, the book, of course, was timed to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Apollo 15, and it's not so much about the rover per se, although the rover was the key ingredient to what made those missions different. It's about the last three missions. The central thesis of the book being that every piece of the U.S. space program leading up to 1971, going all the way back to Alan Shepard's first flight in a Mercury capsule in 1961, was preparation for those last three missions. We tend to think of Apollo as reaching its peak with Apollo 11, and then there were some missions that followed, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk on the moon. And then, we had a half dozen missions that did other stuff. And that's not the way it was at all. The Apollo 11 was a development mission, laying the groundwork for the much more ambitious missions to come.
Yeah, and the rovers made that really possible, didn't they?
They did. The rovers were part of a full Apollo upgrade that began with 15, in which you had a more capable and heavier lunar module that could stay on the surface for 3 days versus two. You had improved spacesuits, or EMUs, as NASA called them, extra vehicular mobility units, and a much improved backpack that increased the amount of time that they could spend outside. But the defining improvement was that they had a rover that enabled them to cover much greater pieces of the moon's surface. To the extent, to put it in realistic terms, that terrestrial terms, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin never got farther than 65 yards from their lunar module. All of their travels would fit inside a football field with a lot of yardage to spare. And then you have Apollo 15, which traveled 17.25 miles across the Hadley-Apennine region of the moon. Took astronauts, took Dave Scott and Jim Irwin hundreds of feet up the side of a mountain the size of Kilimanjaro, enabled them to explore along the edge of a canyon that was a mile wide and 1,000 feet deep. And that little car, which weighed less than 80 pounds in the lunar surface, gave them a range roughly the size of Manhattan.
Well, what I'm really interested to talk to you about today is we're doing a program on the two Mars rovers, kind of an update on them, curiosity and perseverance. And what I'd like you to do is give us kind of a family tree, because the lunar rover and the Mars rovers are quite different machines, but they are all part of a family tree, if you will. Could you go back to the roots of this? How did this idea begin of we're going to make a vehicle to travel around on another world?
This really dates back to the late 1950s, 1960, and two immigrants to the United States, a Polish refugee by the name of M.G. Greg Becker, and his right-hand man, Ferenc Frank Pavlik, who was a Hungarian refugee of the 1956 uprising there. And they worked for General Motors at a defense research laboratory the company had established in Santa Barbara, California. And their jobs were specifically to look at off-road technology that GM could employ in pitching projects to the U.S. military. GM was at one time a huge defense contractor back in the 40s and early 50s. They had lost a lot of that business. They were eager to get it back. And so these guys were part of a kind of a multi-pronged effort to pitch GM products to all of the services. But Becker and Pavlik were specifically aimed at Army applications, and were well qualified to do it. Becker had pretty much single-handedly invented a field of engineering called Terra Mechanics, which is the study of the relationship between vehicles and the ground over which they study or they travel. So if you've ever bulldozed or driven a tank or gone mudding in a Jeep or raced motocross or even ridden a mountain bike, you owe a piece of that experience to Greg Becker and the research he did into tire treads, Caterpillar tractor treads, all manner of locomotion across unpaved surfaces. Anyway, in the days after Sputnik, both of these men became fascinated with the prospect of applying what they were doing for earthbound vehicles to a vehicle to travel the moon. And it seemed inevitable, I think, to them that with the space program gearing up, it was only a matter of time before we sent astronauts to another celestial body, whether it was the moon or elsewhere. And Becker was firmly convinced that being Americans, those astronauts would not be content to just hoof it across the surface. They'd want to drive. And so using a number of, really guessing at a number of analogs for lunar soil, they started experimenting with a number of machines that they thought might be suited to getting to the moon and carrying equipment or people around its surface. And, you know, one of the things that they came upon after a couple of years of experimentation was that the most capable model of vehicle for any off-road application was a six-wheeled, 6x6. In other words, it was a six-wheeled vehicle that had an independent motor in each wheel. And it had a flexible frame as well. So you had, if you can picture the six-wheeled vehicle, three pairs of wheels with a frame that was completely elastic between each axle, basically. And what that enabled such a vehicle to do was to keep its wheels firmly planted on the ground, no matter how crazy that ground might get. And it also enabled this thing to climb almost eerily. You know, the six-wheeled prototypes that they built in the very early 60s for the Surveyor probe program, pre-Apollo, could climb vertical walls almost two times as high as the wheels were in diameter. I mean, it was these things were incredibly capable, really sure-footed. They were mountain goats in robotic form. And as it happened, GM worked with NASA all through the 60s to develop various forms of rovers as the space agency saw them taking shape at that point. And they were all six-wheeled, all 6x6. GM stayed true to that vision and true to the belief that that was the configuration that made the most sense. And then NASA, in 1967, when NASA's budget was slashed, the space agency pretty much walked away from the idea of putting a rover on the moon during Apollo. it just didn't see a way that it could get one of the rovers it had envisioned at the time to the moon without a separate rocket carrying it. And the budget wouldn't allow a second rocket permission. And at that point, Becker and Pavlix, having spent the better part of a decade working on these ideas, weren't content to just walk away. They decided that they would continue pursuing the idea on GM's dime. And in very short order, in a matter of months after NASA effectively killed the program, Frank Pavlix developed a way to shrink down the last GM prototype so that it could be folded like a business letter and crammed into a tiny nook in the descent stage of the lunar module, a space about the size and shape of a pup tent standing on its end. And they sold it to NASA. They sold it to Wernher von Braun, who then sold it to the rest of NASA's leadership. And the rest is history.
Yeah, and that's the four-wheel rover that we remember from the Apollo program. Could you like fast forward now to the 90s, the 2000s, and now? What about the rovers on Mars? What kind of lineage can we trace back to the originals?
Well, just to make one point further about Becker and Pavlix, and that is, had they had the option of going with a six-wheeled rover for Apollos 15 through 17, they would have. They continue to believe that six wheels was the way to go. And it was only because they didn't have space in that tiny cargo hold on the descent stage of the lunar module that they went to four. You fast forward then to the mid-1980s, and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is looking for an unmanned rover to send to Mars, a mini rover in its first iteration, Sojourner. And they pulled out some of the old GM ideas from the Surveyor program, and they came to the conclusion that six wheels, a 6x6, was in fact the most capable platform for such a vehicle. And so they started messing around with it. One thing that they became convinced of pretty quickly was that Becker's idea about a flexible frame probably wouldn't work. What they had to do was come up with a design that would achieve the same ends, but do it differently. And so one engineer in particular at JPL, a man named Don Bickler, working sometimes at home in his garage, started messing around with an end run around the problem of, how can you emulate a flexible frame, an elastic frame, without having any elastics involved? And what he came up with was a suspension system that wasn't actually part of the vehicle's body. So you had a vehicle, and then the suspension was kind of rigged to its sides, but these suspension modules were completely independent of the vehicle itself. And these suspension pieces didn't contain a single spring. They were an erector set of struts and arms that pivoted so that as this thing moved, it acted just like Becker and Pavlix's old models with a flexible frame. And that's called the rocker bogey suspension system, which Don Bickler patented in 1989. Now, if you were to look at direct lineage between that four-wheeled rover that went to the moon and Sojourner and every rover that has come since, all of the Mars rovers have used Bickler's rocker bogey suspension. The Mars rovers are much more involved machines.
Yeah, but the lunar rover is a branch off of that, the trunk of that original tree that they began.
Well, that's it. Exactly. It's kind of a dead end trunk. What you have is a direct lineage between that original GM six-wheeled rover and the Mars rovers. Those are very similar. The lunar rover is kind of a branch of the family that went off to the side and dead ended. And we may see it picked up again, as we contemplate further exploration on the moon and eventual human exploration of Mars. We may see a four-wheeled, two-seat rover come to the fore again and piggyback on the research that was done in the 1960s on the Apollo model.
Well, Earl, thanks so much for sharing this incredible story with us. of the family tree of the rovers, because it really is interesting if you go from the little Sojourner rover that was, you know, basically kind of like the size of maybe like a kid's toy, really, not very large. And then Spirit and Opportunity were, you know, kind of like golf cart size. And then you get to Curiosity, which is the size of, you know, kind of a little minivan. And now with Perseverance, you know, you got a big vehicle up there.
Yeah, yeah, it is a big vehicle, and it, you know, utterly dwarfs the lunar rover. You know, the lunar rover was built, it was such a light vehicle that that it could only operate in 1/6 gravity. So there was no way to really test it on Earth. So if an astronaut, to show you how light it was, if an astronaut had stepped aboard the machine on Earth, he would have broken it. He would have broken right through the floorboard, which was only a 50th of an inch thick. It was a sheet of ribbed aluminum that was about as thick as the thinnest of wood veneers on a cheap piece of furniture. So it's, you know, this, it was, for 1969, an incredible piece of engineering, but next to the Mars rovers, it was pretty much kid stuff.
Thanks again to our guests, Perseverance rover scientist Vivian Sun, Curiosity rover engineer and camera team lead Doug Ellison, and Earl Swift, author of Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover, and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you could do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.